miles of black ribbon on the lone highway. Men turn into boys on the lone highway. Rest up creeps cry on the lone highway. Pretty girls beware out on the lone highway. On the lone highway. Revolution Radio, it's Saturday, and it's time for the Scorpio Conspiracy Show with your host, Scorpio. Lost a little honey on the lone highway.
Let me pour another. Hello, and welcome to Operation Scorpio. Today's date is Saturday, August 22nd, 2020. Wow, 2222. And welcome to the free-range open-air insane asylum we call Earth. Yes, the clock is ticking. Tick, tick, tick. How long before people have had enough? That's my question. Enough of hoaxed news stories, hoaxed pandemics, whose numbers have been massaged and vastly overcounted. Fake foundations that are used as global money laundering operations, and a fake federal government that pretends to help society, when in fact it's covertly working towards the destruction of civilization as we know it. I mean, seriously, when are people gonna reach the breaking point and say enough? And, you know, I truly believe that we are living through the attempted controlled demolition of Western civilization and all that it holds dear. Yeah, guys, make no mistake, that's what's really going down. And man, I don't know if any of you guys have been watching the Democratic National Convention. But man, let me tell you, it's hard to watch on a variety of different levels. And anyone that's watched some of that knows exactly what I'm talking about. You know, on one level, it's just kind of a, you know, a clown show, you know, a clown circus full of, bizarre circus clowns and, you know, a cringeworthy event that is, you know, hollow, vacuous, and phony, you know, almost beyond words, the bizarreness of this event. And, you know, it's the first convention ever where there's only a handful of people present. You know, pretty much an empty convention center. And, you know, I saw like maybe 10 people on the floor there. And, you know, seeing an empty convention center is both ominous and foreboding. Because really, you know, it's sort of a possible view into the future that our hidden overlords have in store for us. I mean, I've never seen anything like it. And if nothing else, you know, it's sort of a testament to the covert power of a handful of people who own and operate the system in which we live. Yeah, you know, and on one level, it's easy to kind of laugh at the, you know, at the cast of circus clowns and freaks and weirdos and degenerates. You know, it's easy to laugh at that. And, you know, no matter what your spiritual path is or your moral code, if you have any kind of moral compass or spiritual discernment, the path that these progressive politicians want to take America on is a ride down into the abyss. Into the abyss, guys. And, you know, it'll be a journey that ends in the destruction of freedom, basic morality, and, the future of America's young people. And the future of the world's youth, for that matter. And inside this Democrat National Convention, you know, we are seeing people who are untalented and unskilled and, frankly, you know, have a room temperature IQ. And these people, these same people, are being elevated into positions of leadership where they are not qualified and, frankly, do not belong. And obviously the end result from these kinds of people running the show will be the complete and utter collapse of civilization as we know it. And we're already seeing that, you know, with some of these cities that are just being intentionally destroyed by the people that are supposed to be running them. But of course, this is all being done on purpose and part of a greater plan, I believe. You know, a covert plan to reshape the very civilization in which we live. And, you know, the number of transgender activists that are part of this DNC platform, oh man, it's truly shocking. And, you know, you have to watch the portion of this convention that happens during the day, because, you know, the prime time, they're only showing you, you know, the rising stars. But if you watch some of these daytime conversations, let's say, between these people, I mean, it's a collection of, you know, transgender people, too many. And, you know, I'm not hating on these people. You know, I think they're horribly confused, both spiritually and mentally, and, you know, mentally ill, essentially. And, you know, don't forget that these kinds of people were defined as mentally ill even back in the 1980s. The official Association of Psychiatrists and Psychologists deemed these people, even though, back then, to be essentially mentally ill. But now there are leaders, and they're, you know, they're being elevated to, you know, examples for our youth to follow somehow, which is a recipe for disaster. And they know this. They know this. And, you know, I think these people deserve some degree of compassion, but to elevate them into leadership and role models for our youth is an inversion of what society and humanity is supposed to be. And, you know, it's like, how many black women and lesbian mayors and police chiefs are there? I mean, it's just mind-boggling. But then at the same time, oh, we have systemic racism. Oh, hell yes, hell yes. Yeah, everything's being inverted right now, on purpose, of course. And, you know, but conversely, you know, I've got to be objective here. You know, old Uncle Joe Biden, he did manage to pinch out a pretty decent speech, in all fairness. You know, not that I support him or believe anything he says. But I think, in order to see what's really going down, we have to be objective and learn to see things outside of our own filters, right? You know, and honestly, you know, I think Trump is in serious trouble right now. The arrest of Steve Bannon, as phony as it is, it looks very bad to the average normie, you know, despite the obvious fact that it's just another example of this selective enforcement by the FBI, you know, which has been a deeply corrupt organization since its very inception. You know, how long was J. Edgar Hoover? They had like 40 years, close to 40 years. And we had this essentially a homosexual transvestite that refused to admit the existence of the mafia. Well, because they had, let's say, pictures of old J. Edgar in some compromising positions, let's say. The top law enforcement guy in the country didn't know about the mafia. Right. But, you know, I got to say, man, anyone that's predicting a Trump landslide, I think, is kidding themselves. It's not going to be anywhere close to that. And I don't think it's in the cards. And if Trump does manage to win, which is certainly possible, it will be very close. But the problem is, there'll be immediate claims of an illegitimate victory, you know, followed by riots, and much bigger riots than the ones we've seen already. Much bigger. That's already planned, and it's baked in the cake, guys. And of course, you know, no matter who wins, there's going to be a lot of pissed off people, right? I mean, essentially, you're going to have at least half of the country thinking that the election was fixed. That's baked in the cake. And, you know, we're being set up for this. You know, the foreshadowing is being drawn out, and, you know, little hints and breadcrumbs are kind of being dropped before us on both sides, right? And again, if we look at Joe Biden as a candidate from outside, you know, my filter or the filter of most people listening to this show, in some ways, you know, as strange as this sounds, he is a good candidate for what the Democrats are trying to push. And don't laugh. I know it's easy to laugh at how feeble and ridiculous the man is, but look at it from the filter of someone on the other side of the equation here, right? Because, you know, if we only view the world through our own filters, we're just going to see what we want to see. And, you know, that's dangerous for any of us who are trying to decipher, you know, truth from deception. But let's look at Gropin' Joe. He's corrupt. You know, he's been part of this club for 50 years. He's malleable in the sense that he doesn't really have any beliefs other than, you know, helping out Joe and his overlords, you know. So he's malleable. He'll do what he's told. And he has a short shelf life. I mean, he most likely wouldn't make it through his first term. So, you know, if he happens to die in office or become incapacitated, no one's going to really, you know, raise an eyebrow. It's not going to look suspicious like, oh, yeah, we already knew that, you know, he was not doing so well. It's been foreshadowed, you know, by these covert script writers and psychologists who are writing the political novel that we're supposed to experience here, guys. And the other thing about Joe is he's non-threatening, right? And he makes good cover for the, you know, the radical globalists that are pulling his, you know, his puppet strings. And, of course, this COVID crisis benefits Gropin' Joe a lot, doesn't it? It ain't that convenient, huh? You know, Trump can't have any more of his mega rallies that show how popular he is amongst a huge portion of society, packing in 20, 30, 40,000 people with another 5 or 10,000 people outside. Nope, can't do that anymore. And, you know, Gropin' Joe didn't even show up to the convention hall, man. He did his speech from a remote location. I don't remember where, but he wasn't in Milwaukee when he gave the speech. And, you know, the speech was obviously pre-recorded and probably highly edited. I mean, the guy probably took, you know, okay, Joe, take 40, click. You know, I mean, who knows? But the finished product was fairly polished for the target audience that he was going after, man. And these debates, if they actually happen, I think there's three scheduled, but we'll see. If they actually happen, you know, they'll probably be done remotely without the two men even being face to face. And, you know, obviously in a real debate, Trump would mop the floor with the guy, right? I mean, it'd be an embarrassment. But in a virtual debate, just like the virtual convention, you know, Joe's going to have pre-access to all the questions and, again, have one of these polished, pre-recorded responses that would give him, you know, pretty much full protection from the heat and the stress of a real debate. Yeah. So if we follow this foreshadowing and the real, you know, the little trail of breadcrumbs that the mainstream media is dropping all around us, you know, we're supposed to believe that, you know, Biden, he's this wonderful person. He's out there helping old ladies cross the street, right? And helping, you know, courageous kids who suffer from, you know, speech impediment, you know, stuttering. Well, at the same time, you know, Trump is out there kicking puppies. Yeah, he's kicking puppies and, you know, he's a super spreader for COVID and he's going to destroy our democracy. Right, guys? That's the message we hear from this unified front of the media. That's really just a propaganda arm and, you know, a psychological manipulation machine. So we're about to enter into the most manipulated and fixed election in modern history. There is no question about that. You know, I haven't even gone into all the manipulation through, you know, Facebag and Google and all these other, you know, and Twitter, all these other, you know, social media mechanisms that everyone listening already knows about, you know, the one-sided banning of political thinking and free thinking. So yeah, we got this unified front against the evil orange man who's gonna destroy our democracy. And only Groping Joe and Kamala can save us. Oh man, it's like a comic book, isn't it? And look, whether you love Trump or you hate him, the one thing his presidency has taught me, and I think the biggest lesson out there, is that the power of the presidency is essentially inconsequential compared to the power and momentum of this deep state agenda that just keeps rolling along no matter which party is in power. You know, you got the fast lane with the Democrats and the slow lane with the Republicans. That's really what it boils down to. And, you know, some people say, oh, Trump's just an actor and this is all just a stage show. I don't believe that. I think he did have good intentions, but he really hasn't been able to do a whole lot of his agenda. And, you know, again, this thing with Bannon being arrested, it's sort of a twofer, isn't it? Because it makes Trump look corrupt. You know, all of his associates are, you know, being thrown in jail, essentially, or charged. It looks bad, no matter how bogus all the charges are. And it's a twofer because, oh, look, the wall is a corrupt entity. It's a corrupt project. It's not good. So, yeah, you know, and also this the timing of this arrest is certainly very convenient, isn't it? What, like 2 or 3 days before Groping Joe takes the nomination. That's very convenient, isn't it? So yeah, you know, there's a unified front against Trump. And I think the main reasons for this absolute hatred of the man is one, he hasn't gone along with the climate change agenda. You know, he said not doing the whole Paris Accord, not going to go into this green energy thing, which it would be a great idea if they weren't withholding the advanced technologies that could make it possible. Because, you know, I hate to tell you guys, but windmills and solar panels aren't going to power major cities. But I think most people listening already know that. And I think the other reason that Trump is so hated by these insiders and the swamp, whatever you want to call it, I think, you know, John Bolton actually revealed it accidentally in some ways, because, you know, Bolton was complaining about how Trump trusts his instincts and doesn't listen to advisors, which really is sort of a covert way of saying, we usually use all these advisors that we stack into his cabinet from the Council on Foreign Relations, the Bilderberg Group, and the Trilateral Commission. And usually presidents listen to those guys. But Trump doesn't listen, and we don't like that. And you can see that, you know, the guy's political instincts are pretty good. You know, he tried to call this COVID thing out as a hoax at the very beginning. He wanted to cozy up to Russia, which strategically was definitely the smartest move on many levels. But they put it into that, didn't they, with this Russia hoax and making him look like a Russian agent. And again, you know, this whole Russia thing was a psychological masterpiece, because they're drawing on this old sort of DNA of the United States that, you know, oh, the Soviet Union and communism, Russia. And so they're drawing on this old kind of precept that was already in people's minds from the past. And of course, the Soviet Union doesn't even exist anymore, but never mind that. So yeah, this thing with Bannon, it looks bad, especially to normies. And, you know, it's just another example of how this FBI is nothing more than an enforcement tool of the global elite to take out their political enemies and whoever they see fit. I mean, if the FBI looked into any of our lives, they could probably find some charge to charge you on and throw you in jail for 20 years, man. And, you know, the only other thing the FBI does is they cook up these phony terrorist threats, you know, by attaching themselves to mentally ill people and sort of pushing them in the right direction, and then hand them a fake bomb and go, oh, look, another terrorist. Yeah, so, you know, they're losing all credibility to anyone that's knowledgeable, but to the average normie, I think this Bannon thing looks pretty bad. And, you know, even though this whole thing is ridiculous on the face, Bannon's personal wealth has been estimated to be, you know, $100 to $200 million. You know, and the guy worked, Goldman Sachs is some big shot investor type. Then, you know, he was one of the first original investors in the Seinfeld show. So, you know, which was obviously a hugely successful show. The guy made tons and tons of money because he got on the ground floor of that show. And we're supposed to believe that he gets involved in this embezzlement thing. And they're only claiming that Bannon and his associates embezzled hundreds of thousands of dollars. I mean, that's pocket change on the level that these guys are playing on. And look, you know, it's also ridiculous because what most of these foundations and nonprofits, they only use 10% of their income for their so-called cause that they're supposed to be representing. The rest goes into expense accounts and, you know, just eaten up by salaries, bloated salaries. So this is just ridiculous. But again, it looks bad. And, you know, what we got General Flynn, Roger Stone, Paul Manafort. And, you know, here Paul Manafort gets thrown in jail doing the exact same lobbying work that the Podesta brothers were in the Ukraine or wherever it was. And he gets thrown in jail, and the Podestas were allowed to register as lobbyists retroactively. Amazing. Yeah, so I don't know, guys. I think a lot of these centralized institutions are losing their credibility, not just the FBI. More and more people are starting to see that big government and these organizations that surround it are just parasites that are feeding on the labor of people who actually produce real goods and perform real labor. You know, that's the economy. Not foundations, not, you know, all these bloated government jobs, and not the stock market, you know, adding zeros to computer screens. You know, and we've all been so brainwashed to think, oh, yeah, stock market guy, that's an important guy. Stock market, yeah, blah, blah, blah. Well, hey, what's more important, a stock market trader or a plumber? Well, the answer is pretty obvious if you go just one day without a bathroom. So look, guys, you know, the government isn't going to do shit point five to solve our problems. And, you know, all this cheerleading, hey, our side's got to win the election. And I agree, it's better if Trump is back in office. But I think the time to keep looking to the federal government to solve everything, those days are coming to an end. Because think about it. I don't think there's anyone that's listening to the sound of my voice that can make the honest argument that the federal government has been a good thing overall, you know, that its good deeds have outweighed its bad deeds. Not even close. And, you know, just looking at World War I, World War II, and, you know, the government forcing the population to participate in those two wars, that alone would be enough to condemn the federal government, because there's no way that the American people would have participated in either one of those wars. If you look at the history, they weren't popular wars by any stretch of the imagination, especially World War I. Nobody in America wanted anything to do with it. And President Wilson proceeded to put people in jail who spoke out against the war. It's really an incredible story if you look into the actual techniques that were used to silence people. So between these two wars, you got, what, 40 million that died in World War I, and somewhere between 70 and 86 million people died in World War II. And apparently, they're calculating that it was 3% of the world's population died in World War II. And that doesn't even count all the people that were, you know, wounded physically, mentally, and spiritually. And it's funny how we never hear these numbers, 86 million people. All we hear about are the 6 million, right? That's the only figure we ever hear over and over. And of course, repetition is the very soul of propaganda, isn't it? But yeah, we're supposed to, humanity was saved by World War II. Oh, really? Yeah, I don't think that's really true. And, you know, if America hadn't gotten involved in World War I or World War II, they both would have ended much sooner, much, much sooner. And, you know, here, what, during World War II, Germany and Russia invaded Poland. And that was the big trigger. Oh, you know, we can't let the Germans invade Poland. But, well, the Russians did, but don't worry about that. Yeah, so I don't know, guys. I don't think that we can look to the federal government anymore. Even if Trump does win, man, look what they've done to him. So it's time to start thinking outside that paradigm. Because, as I said, this is the world wars that we were involved in. That alone is enough to condemn our federal government. And here, what Roosevelt allowed Pearl Harbor to happen as a pretense to get Americans fired up because nobody wanted to be involved in it. World War I, it just happened 20 years earlier, wiped out a whole generation of young people, man. Nobody wanted anything to do with it. So the federal government intentionally moves all the ships that were in other parts of the world into Pearl Harbor, which is just the perfect target. They might as well just put a big, you know, sign out there, attack us, please. Yeah. So anyway, I think that we need to start looking outside the box and not looking to the federal government any longer. Because, look, let's fast forward to today. Does anyone out there really think they could have pulled off Operation COVID without the full force and power and support of this federal government? And federal governments worldwide have all been colluding to make this hoax. Yeah, I called it a hoax. Happen. To make this hoax happen. And of course, you know, the United Nations and all of its tentacles are a central part of this as well, which is, you know, intended to be the central government of central governments, much like the Bank of International Settlements is supposed to be the central bank of central banks. So as long as we keep thinking in these same terms, we're just going to be heading for the same kind of problems and disasters, no matter who's at the helm. Although I do agree that having Trump in charge is certainly better than Gropin Joe and his merry band of globalists and communists and the general freak show that's part of his entourage, let's say. Well, that said, I would like to bring on Giuseppe from the District of Criminals, a true American. Giuseppe, how you doing, buddy?
Scorpio, come here. Let me sniff your hair. I'm groping Giuseppe.
Oh, hey, man, it's those little good girls that have the best smelling hair, though.
That's right. I'm doing well, and great intro, man. I took some notes, and there's all your points are always so dead on and salient, but the first one that I noticed, the observation, is the weaponized minorities, be it the Jew, the lesbian, the homosexual, the black, they all, if they take to the streets and hate civil European society, what drives them is mental illness. I mean, you know, what is downplayed is the majority, by a vast majority, of blacks in this society are working class, middle class, and doing pretty well. And it is tragic that the impoverished, the lowest economic class, just are hopeless and nihilistic and self-damaging, self-mutilating, and they have no hope. And they've been used for decades as a bludgeon against the other economic classes. And it's just so evil, and people don't look at it as a class struggle, when in reality it's a class struggle that could have been fixed decades ago in 1965, instead of the Equal Rights Amendment and things of that nature to support the lower economic classes. Why didn't you have a realistic approach and offer many, many different kinds of job opportunities that would have kept the family unit stable and prevented the complete disintegration of the urban family?
Well, yeah, and you know, you made a good point that this counter movement against Western civilization is based on hate, absolute hatred. You see these people in the streets, they're full of hate, but we're the ones accused of being haters. And, you know, when you watch these protesters, they all got their cell phone in their hands, which is, I find, ironic.
The second point, if you believe the federal national elections are legitimate, and there are some major questions dating back decades about how they are fixed and now hacked the last 30 years. But if you believe they are legitimate, then the only way you can interpret the absolute hate and attack on Trump since he was elected, because he was elected by the typical silent majority of the decent white European and working class, middle class, any color, who wants a more stable society and is committed to their opportunity in a stable society. And when you understand that, then you know that the reason they've trumped up these ridiculous charges first against Manafort and then now against Bannon, which is even more ridiculous because, as our former guest, Google whistleblower Zach Voorhees, tweeted out a couple days ago when this first happens, he said, look, you know, the money they're accused of is only about 4% of the revenue taken in. So essentially, they just paid themselves salaries, and that's what every nonprofit does. There's nothing wrong with that, but they're so trying to squash the decent white majority who should rule this country, who should be the focus of every aspect of this society, and they're trying to say, no, whitey, you've got to let these weaponized mentally ill minorities take over and run the asylum. And that just offends me to my core.
Yeah, that's a good point. And, you know, I remember when Bob Dole was running for president back in, was it the early 90s, I believe?
Bob Dole.
And his wife was the head of the Red Cross, right? And I remember it came out that back in at that time, she was being paid $350,000 a year to be part of the head of the Red Cross, which is, you know, they're out there saving children and people, and it's just, you know, this magnanimous thing. Well, why does the head of it need to make $350,000? And that was back in the 90s. I don't even know what the head makes now. You can count it on it. It's a lot more than that now.
Well, the ridiculous of mainstream pseudo-corporate charities is best exemplified by the United Way. The CEO of the United Way makes about $2 million annual salary. And 90% of all donations, because they spend so much money on their slick advertising, multimedia marketing campaign, the United Way cares. Give to the United Way, please. We're helping people. And you know what? Only 10% of that money goes to charities. 90% fuels the United Way bloated machine.
Wow, that's amazing. I did not know that the head of the United Way makes $2 million. That, I don't even know, how could you accept such a salary and say that you're working for charity? It's repulsive and disgusting on its very face.
Well, that's the arrogance of the modern Bolshevik Democrat, that we're above the average, the great unwashed, and we're doing this as a noble cause, and I rub elbows with CEOs, and I deserve to make my $1.75 million or whatever. It's not quite $2 million, but it's up there, 1.7 something or whatever.
Well, even six figures is an outrageous salary if you're working for a charity. My God, I don't know how people live with themselves like that. It's amazing the phony morality that these people hoist upon us.
Right. Oh, and your excellent observation to my third point of the false flag that was Pearl Harbor is it's fascinating and underreported in history that the Navy admiral who was in charge of Pearl Harbor was scapegoated, like it was his fault. And he fought back and eventually won his case and had his name and commission restored. And most people don't understand that. So essentially, he proved Roosevelt knew what was going on, and it was a false flag, never reported.
Was that Admiral Kimmel?
I think that's his name. I didn't look it up to get the exact name, but I think so, yeah.
Yeah, and of course, the reason for this great hoax was that Americans wanted nothing to do with World War II. They had just suffered through World War I 20 years earlier, and most people just saw it as a European conflict, and isolation, so-called isolationism, was very predominant at that time in American politics.
Well, right. I mean, Henry Ford had produced his epic series, The Internationalist Jew, and there was a great awareness of the globalist parasites trying to infiltrate America. America's hero, national hero, Charles Lindbergh, was against the internationalist Jew and also against involvement in the Second World War. And at one point, it was like 50 percent against involvement and 46% for the war. So there, a majority of Americans were against it.
Oh, absolutely, absolutely, and yeah, Lindbergh was a true hero in many, many ways. And of course, you know, I'd like to look more into this, his Lindbergh baby being kidnapped and murdered. There's something stinks about that, because of course a German immigrant did it.
Massad of the day. That was a complete setup. The internationalist Jew kidnapped and killed the Lindbergh baby and set up that poor working class German, Bruno Hopmuller or something, I think his name was.
Yeah. So, yeah.
What a scam. Just shows the complete satanic morality of the internationalist Jew.
Yeah. Yeah. It's amazing. It really is. It is.
And then finally, it's funny, you mentioned the noble, great American J. Edgar Hoover, which is so funny. They had the mafia had pictures of him and his lover boyfriend, and they literally blackmailed America's number one cop for decades, and yet he still managed.
Yeah, Clyde Tolson.
Clyde Tolson, exactly. And he still managed, because he had blackmail pictures of all the top politicians, like the Kennedy brothers, and even before that, he had dirt on everybody. So it just shows how unseemly, like a literal bubbling cesspool, that Washington, D.C., the District of Criminals, has been for so long.
Yeah, and I want to do a show in the future on the FBI, because it's a deeply corrupt organization, and it has been since its very inception. And I want to look into some of these cases where in depth, you know, these supervillains were running around robbing banks and doing all these horrible things, and that's why we had to have the FBI. And I'd like to look into this in depth, because I think the whole thing was a scam from the very beginning.
Absolutely agree. And it's interesting that if you think about it, you step back for a second, teeny tiny Tony the Rat Fauci is essentially J. Edgar Hoover 2.0. His one skill is being just a manipulative weasel, and he is like the grade B horror movies that used to be on, coming from the 1950s comics Tales from the Crypt, where Fauci is the little vampiric monkey, and he the evil organ grinder is Big Pharma. Fauci is the little animal who serves Big Pharma so effectively that he's kept in place. And that's exactly how J. Edgar Hoover served organized crime for five decades. Fauci is J. Edgar Hoover 2.0.
You paint a great picture there with the organ grinder and the monkey. That's great. I want to give a quick shout out to the people in the chat room. We got a lively conversation going on there. So anyone listening, come aboard freedomslips.com and come on the chat room and get involved in the conversation. We got Fact or Theory at the top of the list, and he is a host here at Revolution Radio as well. His show comes on Sunday nights, 10 p.m., and he covers a whole variety of subjects. Very interesting show, so check it out. So we got Fact or Theory, Susie Q 909, Lily V, the mechanic, who runs some wild, wild roundtables late night here on Revolution Radio. Make sure to check those out too, man. That guy's got some good stuff, man. Plant manager, Big D, Snippets, Jer Bear 2, Lady Horse, Wild Bob, Maced 139, Mona Radler, Mayor Bailey, Monster 383, Comet, Omega Logos, Sonali, Popsicle Toes, Wall E, Blasphemous Buddha, Cat Dog Girl, Dirt Engineer SJ, Patrick Rabbit, Mr. Rowe, Surrey Sunflower, Lioness, and Free Hugs. Okay, so everyone, thanks for being in the room, and I'm seeing lots of good comments, so we'll get to those later. So, Giuseppe, what other observations do you have at the top of your head now?
Well, before I go to my what is just infuriating me, I want to point out that a big fan of your show, Snippets, does an awesome compilation of the latest political cartoons and humor and observations, and it's snippets-slapits.blogspot.com. And it's fantastic. I look forward to looking at it and examining it every Saturday.
Yeah, I do too. And, you know, she does a great job of picking out cartoons and memes that are they're funny. They always give you a good laugh, but there's always like a serious dose of truth in there. And, you know, her stuff is always featured at grism.blogspot.com as well. So check that out too. And, yeah, it's, you know, a good laugh is needed more than ever now.
Oh, man, that's the case. So here, talking about foreshadowing, and it just angers me. Last night, Barbara Lowe, who's an excellent anti-vaxxer, has the NVIC website. And she posted this news snippet from Richmond, Virginia, the capital of Virginia, and the headline reads, Virginia Health Commissioner says he'll mandate a COVID-19 vaccine. And you've got this poster child for affirmative action, this Merck rectum licker who has been propped up into a position of authority that he has no business being because he's easily just a mouth breather, a total clown. And he and the story reads, State Health Commissioner Doctor, which is a laugh, Norman Oliver told 8 News on Friday that he plans to mandate coronavirus vaccinations for Virginians once one is made available to the public. This guy is going to get 3 bullets in the back of his head, and he deserves it. I mean, I moved to the Commonwealth of Virginia to avoid the Bolshevik oppression of a state like Maryland, where I lived when I moved out to D.C. the first time in the late 80s. And he goes on, he draws a line in the sand that says, Dr. Oliver says that as long as he is still the health commissioner, he intends to mandate the coronavirus. And then he lies, it's killing people now. We don't have a treatment for it. And if we develop a vaccine that can prevent it from spreading in the community, we will save hundreds and hundreds of lives. No, no, mouth breather. You will kill thousands and thousands of people. And supposedly, presently, under state law, only people with a medical exemption can refuse the mandate. And the Virginia General Assembly is currently considering a bill during an ongoing special session that would allow people with religious opposition to opt out, which is historically in the Virginia Commonwealth has always been there for people to use religious exemption to opt out of public education, and it should be put in. But there's been a big push by the international Bolshevik Jew the last 10 years to take over Virginia, which was historically a red state, and cede the local and regional elections with loyalists like the traitorous Jew mayor of Charlottesville, Virginia now. And here in Northern Virginia, it's Bolshevik Central. It's so offensive to me. And so it's outrageous. I mean, Oliver says, and this mouth breather says he strongly opposes the mandate for religious exemption, which if that doesn't pass, I'll be shocked. But on the other hand, these traitorous Bolsheviks, they've got a small majority in the both Virginia houses, which is just insane that Yorgi Swartz, the traitorous Jew who changed his name to George Soros, and to show the character of that subhuman, he was betraying his fellow Jews to the Nazis as a teenage boy. He was selling out hidden Jews and everything. It just shows what a despicable lowlife he is. And now his money through his vast network of activist Bolshevik traitorous organizations have taken over Virginia slightly. And I'm very curious in this next election. I would hope that Virginia will be taken back as a small majority red state in both houses. I mean, between the what's being done to try and lock down homeschools, the fact that they've already mandated that every child, even children who are homeschools, has to have every vaccination. It's so draconian that I hope that Virginia goes red.
Yeah, and you know, this is a common problem where you have, you know, states where, you know, one or two major cities end up controlling the state, and all the rural people don't have much of a voice as to what's happening in the state. You know, that's a common occurrence now. And, you know, going back to what you were saying, the governor of New Mexico is now saying that she's going to keep these COVID mandates in place permanently. I don't know how she can come to that conclusion. And this dirty communist, Tedros, whatever his last name is, of the World Health Organization, is saying that this pandemic is going to go on for 2 more years. Well, he hopes it'll only be 2 more years. So these people aren't planning on letting this hoax go, because it's working, you know, all the magic that it was supposed to transform and alchemically transform our society.
Well, when you step back and you look at the trauma-induced operant conditioning that's occurred. So first, they did their first great endeavor with the public sacrifice of John F. Kennedy. Then they did the mass blood sacrifice of 3,000 innocents in 9/11 and created the Muslim terrorist boogeyman. Oh my God! Even though it was 19 Wahhabi terrorists, which is 19 Saudi Arabians, and 11 of them came up the next day and were proven to be alive, even though it was those returned from the dead Wahhabi Arabs, we got to attack Iraq, we got to attack Afghanistan. I mean, they milked that for 20 years, and it finally got old, even to the one of the key election points going back to the European majority in this country said enough with these wars for the Jews. And so that ran its course. So now they have the nano-sized invisible terrorist, the coronavirus, which if Americans could think, they'd realize that's just a common cold mutated, but it mutates all the time. And 80% of people already have an immunity to any common cold, even though it has been altered in a lab, and all you got to do is step back. But no, we're so afraid of the nano terrorists. We have to wear our masks and we have to stick tampons in our ears. It's just so insane. Yeah.
Oh, that's funny. So true, man. And Snippets is saying that Soros just took over Canada through Freeland, his protege of 40 years. And, you know, it's just amazing how people like Soros essentially have complete immunity from any and all crimes they commit. I mean, the guy has crashed the currency of several countries and just destroyed people's lives all over the world. And isn't it interesting that all of these wars that resulted from 9/11, most of them were countries where Israel has, sites on taking some of their territory as part of this Eretz Israel or Greater Israel project. Surely that's just a coincidence though, right, Giuseppe?
Oh yeah, it's just a coincidence that the Israeli think tank in the late 90s wrote the Project for a New American Century, which essentially outlined how the United States military would become Luca Brasi, the dim-witted assassin for the Jewish godfather, and go in and wipe out the seven neighbors of Israel, creating the Greater Israeli Project, which created an Israel land from the Euphrates to the Nile. So yeah, just a weird coincidence.
Yeah, and that's what the two blue lines on the Israeli flag represent. But hey, that's just a coincidence too. And, you know, you brought up Luca Brasi. You know, one of the greatest moments in the original Godfather movie was when young Michael is, you know, talking to his fiance about Luca Brasi. And he's saying, well, talking about how the guy kills people and beats people up for his father. And she says to him, well, but Michael, powerful people, legitimate senators and presidents don't have people killed. And he said, well, who's being naive now, Kate? That was like a real moment, wasn't it?
It was. There's, you know, everything you need to know in life you can get from Godfather 1 and 2. Hey, Mikey, don't forget the cannolis.
Yeah, and, you know, that's true. That movie reveals so much, but, of course, we're supposed to think that such behavior is only confined to the mafia, not to legitimate senators and congressmen and presidents. But they actually laid it out there in that conversation. It was really quite amazing. And, of course, they even touched upon the kosher element of the mafia with that character I forget his name, but the Jewish guy that was working with Michael Corleone.
Oh, and Hyman Roth.
That's right. There you go. Go ahead.
Oh, we got here. Comes the break.
Okay. All right. We'll be back after this short break, guys. Take care. Okay. Welcome back to hour two of Operation Scorpio, and. For the next 2 hours, Giuseppe and myself are going to be talking to a true muckraking journalist and an author, Susan Bradford. And Susan is someone that has been behind many investigations. She was one of the lead investigators behind the Abramoff investigation, of the super lobbyist Jack Abramoff, along with the financial, political, and intelligence network within Indian country that traced to London, the international bankers, and the deep state. That will be an interesting story to hear. Susan is a Christian writer whose articles have appeared in many publications, including the European Review, UN Vision, the Washington Times, Capital Research Center, Centers, Organization, Trends, and elsewhere. And she's had quite a long career and done many things. So, Giuseppe, is she ready to come on the show?
Yes, I believe Susan's there. Welcome to Operation Scorpio, Susan. How are you doing this fine Saturday?
Hi, I'm doing good afternoon to both you and Scorpio. Thank you so much for having me today.
Oh, this is great. Well, thanks for coming on. Maybe you could start with how your journey began with sort of investigative journalism and the kind of revelations that it brought into your life.
Absolutely. Yeah, that's a very long, long answer to a short question, but I'll try to keep it brief. I have really been a journalist for most of my life. I started off working at CBS News in Los Angeles. I then wanted to kind of branch out and cover international news as a foreign correspondent. So I went overseas to England to do a master's degree in international relations at the University of Essex. And after graduation, I did receive an offer from CBS News in London to work as a foreign correspondent, but there was certain kind of issues within the Home Office that prevented my visa from being processed. So I came back to D.C. And I worked for Fox News Channel. The news to me looked a little schizophrenic. Like I no longer the news that I had remembered that of being like very credible and straightforward had become a shout fest of different opinion or commentators, kind of yelling ill-informed opinions at each other. I kind of branched out into more of a freelance basis so that I could maintain some type of editorial integrity over my work. And my first, I think, big investigation was the Abramoff case. I was the leading investigator on the Abramoff investigation. And within this case, I discovered that Jack Abramoff, who was at the time one of the most influential and powerful lobbyists on Capitol Hill, had been set up for wrongful prosecution by a partisan Department of Justice. And I tried to figure out, you know, how this was allowed to unfold on Capitol Hill, why the media went along with it, the congressional, the congressmen, the committees, the agencies. In the process, I uncovered the deep state, the different like financial and political networks. And from there, I have exploring different aspects of it, from the churches to, you know, the different agencies. And I've written a number of books since then that have kind of captured different aspects of the deep state.
It's interesting that with the barbecuing of Jack Abramoff, mm-hmm. since then, there's no lobbyists in the media spotlight, no personalities. Even though their despicable power grows more formidable, what are your thoughts on lobbyists hiding under the rocks these days?
That's a very good question. I know that being a lobbyist is frowned upon these days. I still think that there. I mean, I know that there are a lot of I believe lobbyists who joined the Trump administration. They're still out there working on behalf of these multinationals. In fact, right before the coronavirus hit, they convened on Capitol Hill to figure out how they could get their clients as much money as possible from the coming pandemic. So they're still around, though. You know, they're definitely keeping a lower profile.
Yeah, it's really interesting if you think about the precedent set by Jack Abramoff. They now are using that against Manafort and Bannon, in both instances, really just, in my opinion, amazing overreach to skewer these two individuals.
That's very true. And I think in the case of Jack Abramoff, they might have done, you know, something wrong. What I discovered over the course of my research, I think, is pretty self-evident now, that financial interests control every aspect of our government, from the local politicians to the courts, particularly the federal prosecutors. So unfortunately, the powerful special interests are able to use the Department of Justice to prosecute individuals, and generally those individuals targeted, like for the bigger corruption probes, are those who in some way challenge a powerful interest. So basically, those behind it, like they're usually, you know, it could be a corporation, could be a lobbying group, for example, they will target that person who it might stand in the way of their market share, might be, you know, promoting a political agenda that could somehow hinder what they're trying to do. So the federal government and the prosecutors are used as a weapon against them. And it's unfortunate because they have so much power on their side that the person targeted usually doesn't. So, but
when we're seeing that today, of course, with, you know, Roger Stone, even though he got off the hook, and now Steve Bannon, and, you know, to defend a federal case like these people were involved in, it takes millions of dollars, and it pretty much ruins these people financially. Even if you do get off the hook in terms of a prison sentence, you've still spent all of your money on lawyers. What do you think the core reason or the genesis of the investigation into Jack Abramoff's dealings? Why do you think he was brought down?
In his case, there were a few reasons. I think trouble began for him when he acquired the Saginaw Chippewa Indian tribe as a client. At the time, that the tribe was in a lot of turmoil because fictitious Indians who were placed into power by the Clinton administration were trying to usurp money and power from the genuine Indians, and Abramoff represented the Indians of the favor of the political establishment. He was also representing tribes with casinos, and by protecting his clients, he prevented other casinos from entering into their market share. So he pitted himself against a very powerful casino lobby. And then also in Florida, he attempted to acquire a casino fleet that was placed in direct competition with the Seminole tribe of Florida. And as I was able to discover, the Seminole tribe and its agents worked behind the scenes to kind of set him up to, obstruct his plans. And then they prosecution against him. So it was really, in his case, it was about protecting that they wanted to protect their own market share for casinos.
Wow. And, you know, the whole casino business sort of has been laundered in the minds of the public, for lack of a better word. You know, it's always been a business that leads into organized crime and money laundering. What did you find any, sort of tales of money laundering and organized crime when you started looking into this subject?
Yes, yeah, so there's definitely the organized crime aspect, and one aspect that I found very surprising is that the corporations, like the major corporations that have the most influence with the federal government, they were actually using these corporations had set up joint bank accounts with tribal members, and so we were seeing through paperwork that was provided to me by tribal members that that money was being taken from the casinos that often were created with taxpayer money, to help the Indians achieve economic independence, self-sufficiency, and economic development. The money was being siphoned from the tribes through the casinos and into the back door into these private corporations. So they were using tribal money to subsidize their own businesses. And to be honest, I never expected to find that.
Oh, that's interesting. You know, when I was living in San Diego, that was an area back in the 90s and the early 2000s. That's when a lot of these casinos were being set up in the 90s. And I talked one day to this woman in one of the tribes, and she said that, they didn't have a casino. And then one day, this guy in a black limousine shows up to the tribal meeting, and he has a suitcase full of money. And that was the way literally he had a suitcase full of money, and that was the way that the casino began for their tribe.
Oh, that's interesting. For most of the other from like a number of the original tribes that were created in the early 1900s, the Rockefellers, they were part of the political establishment. They were mentored by the Rothschilds. They had set up these Indian tribes as corporations, and then they sued the federal government on their behalf for money or for land that was lost over the course of history. And the money that was paid to those tribes through the Indian Claims Commission, it was to the tune of like millions of dollars per tribe, that became the seed money for the casinos. But I know that since then, since casinos are so lucrative, and in the case of a tribal casino, the profits are not taxed, and there's no accountability for how the money is spent or how it's acquired or where it goes. I'm not surprised, as you said, that there are these heavy rollers who are approaching tribes with suitcases full of money to develop a casino of their own.
Wow, that's interesting. And it's just amazing the breadth and scope of the Rockefellers throughout the 20th century and the 21st century. It's like they have their tentacles in almost every major happening. I didn't know they were involved in the Indian tribes.
Yes, and I can give you a little bit of a background on that. Just to go back into history, most Americans think that the American Revolution, and acquired our independence from England. But actually, after the American Revolution, the British Crown has been trying to restore us to a vassal state. And one of the ways that they did this was through the back doors of Indian tribes. And so they used the Indians they weaponized the Indians against the colonists. And by creating war and strife with the federal government, they were able to put us into debt. With that debt, the Rothschilds were able to, finance the debt and gradually acquire control of the country by controlling our money supply. And by the Second World Wars, the Rockefellers, who were being mentored by the Rothschilds and the British Crown, to essentially eliminate competition and to use the taxpayers to subsidize their businesses and to, to corner the markets, achieve dominant market share. They wanted to use every aspect of society in which they had influence to kind of support that end game. So they controlled through interlocking boards of directors. They controlled the media, the media corporations, the film houses, universities, the foundations, and they worked. They used all of these different entities and moved in lockstep, to achieve their end goal. So you're right.
Well, you bring up a really interesting point about England and trying to regain its control over America. Isn't it interesting that as soon as the first charter of the first Federal Bank for the United States went up, mm-hmm. and it wasn't going to be renewed, all of a sudden we're in the War of 1812, a little more than a decade after the founding of the country. Essentially fighting over a central bank controlled from England.
That's correct. And Alexander created that first bank. He was an agent of the crown, and his fellow founders knew what the game was, and they made sure that the charter was not renewed. But you're absolutely right. The War of 1812 was designed by the crown to involve us in wars that would drag us into debt. To kind of restore us to the colonial status.
It's interesting, Susan, that you speak of the crown, which is essentially located in the city state of London, mm-hmm. and within the alt media truth champions, there's varying opinion. In fact, there's a bright guy on Revolution Radio. We have over 80 different hosts and shows, two studios playing 24 hours a day, 7 days a week. His name is The Watchman, and he believes that the power resides from the city-state of the Vatican, the Holy See, and of course the third city-state is the Washington, D.C., and my opinion, and I'll ask you to comment what your I think already you'll say, but to me, the real power resides in the city of London, with the Holy See being more like the way to cultivate the flock and control through, Marx said, religion is the opiate of the masses, and the muscle, the Luca Brasi, loyal henchman, assassin, is the city-state of Washington, D.C. and the military empire. What are your thoughts on that?
That's a very good question. Each of these areas that you mentioned is a different arm of the deep state. So, Washington, D.C. would be the military arm. London is the financial arm. The Vatican is the religious. The crown is actually illegitimate. During the Napoleonic Wars, the Rothschilds crashed the British economy and crashed the Bank of Britain, and were able to acquire birthing or breeding rights into the royal family. So since the Napoleonic Wars, the British crown has been illegitimate. And since they were illegitimate, the Rothschilds were able to control them. And I do believe that, if I'm not mistaken, I might have to review my history a bit, but I believe that the Vatican holds the wealth for the Rothschilds, a significant degree of it. It's also a clearinghouse for their intelligence. So that
that's interesting. And you know, there's some question about who's working for who when it comes to the relationship between the Rothschilds and the Vatican. Mm-hmm. So it's a very complex issue in some ways. And isn't it interesting that, you know, we have this talk of the global reset we're hearing all about now. And one of the big movers and shakers involved in this is none other than Prince Charles. Mm-hmm. I'm not exactly sure what his qualifications are to be speaking about how to reshape the world's economy, but nonetheless, there he is.
True. From what I've heard from my sources, who I do consider to be credible, Prince Charles is a commoner, and that the royal family is on its way out. And at this point, the royals and their affiliates are trying to negotiate what they can. There's still some hope that they can push through their global agenda, and maybe avoid prosecution or avoid some of the consequences for a lot of the trouble that they brought into the world.
Susan, because you're making the lucid observation that the current residents of the palace in London are illegitimate, are you familiar with the fella? His name is Joseph something. I'm looking it up. Jim Fetzer has interviewed him like 25 times, and he claims he is the legitimate King of England, and I'm looking at Jim's site. I just can't find it. But are you familiar with that gentleman? It's like Joseph something.
I think it's Greg Hallett.
Yes, Hallett. Right. Hallett. Yeah.
Yes, I am familiar with him. I've spoken to him a few times. I was actually very gratified to see that a lot of the information that he has brought forth confirmed what I had researched independently, and I find him to be very credible. And I think that the case that he's making is that since there isn't a legitimate heir to the throne, you would look towards the prophecies. And if you know that there are a lot of Knights Templar and Masons working behind the scenes to fulfill the prophecy, and in order for for the Mashiach or the Messiah to arrive, certain things need to have happened. And it appears that he does possess those attributes. And I know that there's a lot more to the story that I'm aware of, but I do find him very credible. And I think his allegations that the royal family is illegitimate are also very credible.
That's interesting. You touched upon the Freemasons' role in working to try to fulfill these prophecies with the royal family. Could you expand upon that line of thinking a little bit? It's fascinating.
Sure. I hope I do this properly. I know Greg is definitely more better versed in at this than I am, but the Bible is a from what Greg has said is a book of predictions, and it's a code that it maps out like the future of the world. So it's there are a lot of like it's the language is coded within it. The Masons are working to fulfill the revelation. So they might be able to ensure that something happens on a specific day. They will engage in predictive programming to prepare the people for a coming a future event that has been coded in the Bible. So they are, consider themselves to be like the architects of the universe. So they're the ones who are helping, create the conditions to fulfill the prophecy. And I'm not an expert in the subject, but that's kind of the gist of my understanding of what it is.
Well, and it's interesting how they seem to be obsessed with the rebuilding of Solomon's temple. That's the great goal. And what role do you see that in these prophecies or the agenda?
I believe that, again, I'm not an expert, so I'm kind of offering, you know, my two cents. But my understanding is that the Israelites view like the creation of the temple as being like once the temple has been created, the Messiah will come. So I think that's why they're trying to restore it. I'm sure that there's
right.
more to it.
Right, and then a lot of other. I think once the temple is rebuilt, then apparently the Israelis believe that they will ascend, essentially control over the world once that is done. And so it's a very interesting concept. Of course, the only problem is that the Dome of the Rock sits there right now. So there might be a little problem in getting that rebuilt.
That's true. And I believe that the way that this has all been, that the way that the our elites have gone about this has been maybe a little bit less than forthright. And so I think they may be having some difficulties fulfilling what they want. Because this wasn't done through divine providence. They've tried to kind of force it through maybe ahead of time or in a way that wasn't necessarily, you know, according to plan, if you know what I mean.
Susan, how
do you... Absolutely. And of course, you know, if they did somehow destroy the Dome of the Rock, you'd have a major war that would just explode all over the world, essentially. And, you know, I watched a documentary years ago where the Israelis actually have sort of a prefabbed version of Solomon's Temple. It's already in sections in storage in a warehouse ready to go, and they can just piece it together like within literally a couple of days. And you know, the more radical elements within Israel are just waiting for the right time where they can just sort of roll this thing out and bolt it together in an afternoon. It's really quite a strange story.
And I think in order for that to happen, in order for like this to be legitimate, it must fulfill prophecy, which means it must happen in the right circumstances and with the right people, right timing. Everything has to kind of come together. So.
Okay. We're at the bottom of the hour break. This is a fascinating discussion with Susan Bradford, and everyone stay tuned. We'll be right back. Okay, we're back with author and muckraking journalist Susan Bradford. And before we leave the subject of Solomon's Temple, which is a very interesting, you know, subject metaphysically and geopolitically, I was watching a YouTube channel by a guy. He's in Israel, and his channel is called Ask Israelis, Ask Palestinians, something like that. And he goes around essentially just asks Israelis questions, and he asks the same questions of Palestinians to kind of get, you know, their varying views on different subjects. And he asked about the rebuilding of Solomon's Temple and what that would mean for Israel, and should they rebuild it, you know, immediately. And they asked this one old religious guy in Israel, and he said that, yes, we should rebuild Solomon's Temple immediately, because once the Solomon's Temple is rebuilt, the Gentiles will be our servants. And apparently that's part of Jewish prophecy in the Talmud. So I found that to be an interesting conversation. And that was directly from somebody in Israel. Those aren't my words.
Mm-hmm. Yes, that's true. I mean, that sounds more like a kind of like a Rothschild talking point. I mean, they set out a plan in the late 1900s or the 1800s at the Round Table, where they said that they were planning to shore up all the wealth and power within their own hands, and everybody who was not included within their own circles would be reduced to the status of the slaves. And that's also what they're trying to do through this Green New Deal and technocracy, where they're trying to basically deindustrialize the United States to ensure that they have all the technology, that they're able to, you know, live a life of luxury while everybody else is kind of confined to a technological gulag. But I think what the rabbi may not appreciate is that with these elites, they only plan for themselves to have all of that power and for everybody else to, you know, to be enslaved. And the Jewish people will be enslaved along with the Christians. So, you know, he may be a little misinformed on that point.
That's an interesting point because, you know, one way I've heard it put that, you know, what's happening now is we're seeing the purification of the oligarchy with this COVID-19. So a lot of people that thought they were powerful and wealthy are being swept under the bus. Yeah. And, you know, this idea about the Green New Deal is also another fascinating subject because, for one thing, it is not possible to power major cities with windmills and solar panels. And these people damn well know that. And so this is going to result in people living in abject poverty and the inability to do much of anything. What has your research on the New Green Deal found? And where are you with that kind of information?
The Green New Deal has its origins after the World War. Before the World Wars, the economy was based on supply and demand, and afterwards it became based upon energy. Because one of the reasons, there were many reasons for the World Wars, but one of them was that the elites were trying to shore up the energy reserves for themselves. So they had an idea that each person would be, you know, were considered the slaves of humanity would be assigned a unit, and they wanted to track how much energy each person spent and to be able to control and to create an energy and control system over us so that they could manage the expenditure of energy and ensure maximum efficiency. So they were creating a technocracy, and the Nazis who had developed they were developing kind of occult or different science. They were exploring different science or different technologies. The elites kind of built upon the technocratic perspective of the Nazis to create a system that would be based upon cold, hard rationality, that in which the society would rely upon the experts and not on politicians, or like they would rely upon like technological experts for their policy. And we're seeing that today, you know, with Fauci and these others who don't really have a good command of the sciences, but they are regarded as experts who are able to push through agendas. The technocracy acquired a lot of momentum, I believe, during the 1970s. It was championed by the Trilateral Commission, which was founded by David Rockefeller and Zbigniew Brzezinski, who was Carter's national security advisor. And the Trilateral Commission, I'm sure you're familiar with it, but it had intended to create three separate trading blocks in the Orient, Japan, North America, and Europe, and then to merge them together and to create a technocratic a global structure over them. So they were kind of driving these new green energy agendas, and the global warming and climate emergencies are part of them. Now, the global warming and Green New Deal have their origins in the United Kingdom through a group called the Green New Deal Group. And they are currently trying to prolong the coronavirus in order to create the conditions that we had, the economic conditions we had during the 2007-2008 economic crisis, because they believe if that happens, they're going to be able to push through the Green New Deal and entirely deindustrialize the United States. We saw part of the agenda manifested during the Obama administration, you know, when Obama was trying to drive up the price of oil to make it impossible for the average American to be able to drive a car. So what they were planning to do is to transition us from automobiles to electric cars, and eventually keep us, you know, reduce us to the status of China, where we would be, going to our different locations on a bicycle. And by prolonging the coronavirus, they're hoping to create a new normal, and that would be, you know, you can telecommute to your school, to your work from home. You can visit your family through Zoom. You can shop through, online and have a drone visit or drop the, you know, your products off to you. And so they're trying to eliminate any need that you would have to leave your house. And that way they're going to be able to kind of to monitor and control your energy energy expenditure. So the agenda that's being pushed by the Democratic Party, particularly Kamala Harris, AOC, Bernie Sanders, and Biden, are actually advancing this agenda. And in fact, the Green New Deal group has identified Kamala Harris and AOC as the two great leaders in America who are advancing that goal. So I think that's, you know, in a way, Kamala Harris is very dangerous. And I think that, you know, we need to, I'm not trying to campaign for Trump, but I think we really need to help him win the election, because he is doing, you know, everything that he can to stop it. Like he is trying to promote oil and energy development to make sure that we have a steady supply of cheap oil. You know, he's trying to kind of preserve our industries so that we can have our freedoms and you know, have a life that we did before the coronavirus, you know, was brought to our land. I hope I didn't say too much there, but
No, that's fantastic. I'd like to return to a statement before the break that I find fascinating, where you stated that these secret societies, these dark, powerful cults, consider the Bible to be a book of prophecy. And I also want to, you know, before I ask my question and phrase it, to acknowledge that you state in your biography that you're a Christian. So I take it you're a devout Christian. And I myself am deeply spiritual, and it guides my life in every moment. But with that in mind, how do you reconcile that statement when the Bible has been written many times? Constantine, with the Council of Nicaea in the 3rd century, completely took out chapters that dealt with reincarnation, dealt with white magic, dealt with a lot of common beliefs of the day. And then throughout the millennia, major rewrites have occurred. In fact, the latest, it was none other than dictated by the Rothschilds, fixer Samuel Untmeyer, who hired the weasel Cyrus Schofield, who really hated Christianity and hated the British aristocracy, to rewrite the Bible, which is now the King James Bible, and to rewrite, because in reality, Jews are a 6,000-year-old Talmudic Babylonian death cult. And Jesus pointed that out, the Christ, and it's been pointed out many times. Yet now, with the rewrite, they are the chosen people in the Bible, which I find deeply offensive. And this propaganda that we share Judeo-Christian values is like saying we share satanic godly values. I mean, the two beliefs are so contradictory, and yet millions of entrained evangelicals, and there's even now known as Christian Zionists, which again is another oxymoron, like saying devil God. And what are your thoughts on the rewrites of the Bible, and how can it be a book of prophecy with those statements in mind?
That's a good question. So I think when they mean like by the book of prophecy, this was the Bible as it was originally written. And the Vatican, I believe, has some of the you know, the chapters that were taken out. And you're absolutely right that that different, you know, shadowy interests are trying to rewrite the Bible, just as they're trying to rewrite history to, you know, to kind of create an impression or outcome that may not have been the original intention. In terms of the like what you meant what you said about the Jews, now there are the Jews of the Old Testament who follow the Torah, and the Torah is essentially the Bible. There is an element that is Talmudic, and the Talmudic, or the synagogue of Satan, the Satanists, were the Khazars. These were Jews who came from the Khazarian Empire in Russia, whose main orientation in life was towards the acquisition of money and power at any expense. So they had no value for life. They were able to kill without any compassion or any repercussion, you know, in the former Soviet Union. You know, during the Bolshevik Revolution, they had no value for life, you know, during the when they, you know, when millions of Chinese, you know, suffered at their hand. But the Talmudic and the Satanic Jews are different from the Jews who follow the Torah, and there are many Jews who are also not Zionists and oppose, you know, oppose what is being taught, because they believe that to be a good Jew is to follow the biblical codes, is to live a righteous life. So I mean, there are differentiations.
Right.
That's a very good point. And, you know, yeah, human behavior and human groups, it's always very complex. So you can't, you know, it's difficult to shoehorn everybody into one particular belief system or mode of behavior. So that was a very interesting answer. Thank you.
You're welcome. I think even like within our the Christian church, I mean, the Christianity now is not as it was intended. In fact, communism entered the churches at the beginning of the late 1800s, when the globalists were trying to create a religion that would help, you know, create like be a value basis for the global New World Order. The agenda was pushed through the World Council of Churches and the National Council of Churches. And then in the 1800s, the technocracy entered the church. So right now, a lot of Christians aren't even Christians. And I think they're not following, you know, the Bible or the teachings of Jesus.
Yeah, that's an interesting point. And, you know, it's funny how they've used this 501c3 thing is sort of a carrot and a stick against the churches, because really so many churches are afraid to speak their minds when it comes to the issues of morality when combined with politics. And I don't think you can really separate the two. And what are your thoughts on this muzzling of the churches via the 501c3 rules?
Yeah. So I think they don't want the churches to engage in political. I would have to say I would be, you know, in principle opposed to it, because I think in a church you should have a right to express your opinions, you know, freely. But at the same time, you don't want our religious institutions turn into political weapons. And actually, under Obama, that's exactly what happened. He worked through the United Church of Christ, which was originally an amalgamation of, you know, the Congregational, Pilgrim, and Evangelical or Anglican denominations. It was the Church of the Pilgrims, and he helped bring a community organizers to that church, which worked through groups like the Gamaliel organization, which used Saul Alinsky tactics to kind of mobilize the congregations to lobby for Obamacare and other policies that he wanted to ram through. So he definitely, you know, abused the principle of the separation of church and state. So I don't think that was, you know, that was how the churches were meant to be used.
Yeah, and of course, it's all a one-way street. You know, if you use them for the goals of the globalists, well, it's fine. But if you have a opinion contrary, oh, well, then, you know, that's very dangerous, and we really shouldn't allow that.
And I think that's really true everywhere. I think we're finding that if you have, you know, you can support Black Lives Matter at work, but if you were to say, I support Trump, or wear a MAGA hat, you could be fired, you know, for hate speech. So
yeah.
Go ahead. It's so infuriating, Susan, the mind control that's at play. And your book Unmasked really delves into that in a major way. This whole scamdemic is so ridiculous. In fact, you know, my early career, I was a degree journalist in the 80s and wrote for the Milwaukee Sentinel, which was the largest morning daily in the 80s. I have over 500 bylined articles, wow, newspapers, magazines, mm-hmm, especially publications through the 80s. But I saw how, as you described your own path of how despicable it was getting, how much propaganda, how many outright lies. So it was low pay, high stress. So I moved on to entrepreneurial efforts. I failed magnificently. And then in 2005, I did my midlife career change and became a nationally board certified and state licensed doctor of oriental medicine. So I've been in practice now 15 years as an acupuncturist and a Chinese herbologist, and I have a small holistic practice. And what's interesting to me this year, having my degree was a Master of Science in Oriental Medicine, which is one of the few schools that for every Eastern class I took, I had to take a Western class. So their thinking was, nobody's going to know when you tell them you can treat their toxic blood heat. Nobody's going to know what the hell you're talking about. But in my medicine, toxic blood heat, 6,000-year-old, very effective natural medicine, is cancer. And so you can treat everything. And so because I had so many Western classes, and I've been extremely anti-vaccination for decades, I've seen the injury. I mean, it killed my 13-week-old nephew after his second round of vaccinations. He died the next day. There is no SIDS. Mm-hmm. For every one child out of 100 that might suffocate themselves tragically, there's 99 that are murdered by vaccinations. You go back to the origin of vaccinations, the British fellow Spencer, in his arrogance to defeat smallpox, and he murdered his stepson and his own son because he kept testing them, and they both died around the age 20. And the lies of the vaccination industry, yet it was indemnified in 1986 by the young weasel Tony Fauci convincing Ronald Reagan that the industry needs to be protected. And so now literally you've got a criminal cabal, the vaccine industrial complex, who has no ramifications other than the kangaroo vaccine court, and is literally maiming millions of young people, turning them into walking zombies with autism, which is 100% caused by vaccinations, murdering hundreds of thousands of newborns a year with vaccinations when the immune system is not even mature enough to accept the vaccine till about age 3 at minimum. And yet they have the free market would have driven them out of business decades ago. Mm-hmm. And so this evil, and you can tell I'm a little passionate about this. How did you come to write on masks, and what did you discover through the process?
I think all that you said is very, very interesting, and I think what it speaks to is the power that the pharmaceutical industry has over our country. If you look at it and watch the news, the mainstream media, you'll see that most of the ads are on drugs. So they really determine a lot of our the content on the news, because they have such a strong financial stake in what can and cannot be said. Uncovered is that at the end of the Bush administration, the globalists had to find a reason to advance the agenda, to keep the agenda on track. They knew that the public no longer had an appetite for war, and the Obama administration had bankrupted the healthcare industry with the Affordable Care Act. So they decided to hatch the coronavirus pandemic as a way to help fill their coffers and to merge the defense industry, like their defense contracts, with healthcare contracts, which would take the form, for example, of vaccinations and tracking devices and so forth. The coronavirus was actually patented in England by the Pertwright Institute years before the pandemic even broke in the world, in the U.S. The Pertwright Institute is financed by it's actually the founder of Pertwright was a great grandson of Amschel Rothschild, the patriarch of the dynasty, and it's funded by the Gates Foundation, the WHO, European Commission, the Medical Research Council, and they also work with the Wellcome Trust. So they created the vaccine and the coronavirus. And then we know that in order for them to have acquired the patent, they would have had to have gone through companies, the global companies like Serco and Akinetech, in which the queen holds the golden controlling share. So she was able to kind of, you can see like where there's a royal and Rothschild influence within this group. The coronavirus officially debuted in Wuhan, but from what I can tell, it may or may not have come from the lab, but where it did debut was at the World War Games in Wuhan, which was a globalist organization that brought together the armed forces and the healthcare industry. And their supporting organizations are working to coordinate the armed forces and healthcare businesses around the world shore up market share for the pharmaceutical companies. So you can see like how everything was taking shape. They released Wuhan or the virus in Wuhan. Several of the athletes contracted it. At the same time in New York, Bill Gates was hosting Event 201 where they were wargaming the pandemic. And there was another group that's called the Medical Research Council, which falls under the Royal Society. And the Royal Society was created by a royal charter, so it's controlled by the Queen. At the very top, it receives money from the UK Department of Business and Innovation, which kind of coordinates the global multinationals. The MRC is looking at. They're actually, if you read some of their documentation, it's very chilling. They write about how before the pandemic, they established like a baseline of human behavior, and they're tracking how people are responding to lockdowns, to social isolation. They're talking about how by panicking panicking the politicians, the experts are able to kind of dictate the a coronavirus or dictate the policy and the responses to the coronavirus. They're also like coordinating, the research for the WHO. And they're saying that if they can prolong the coronavirus, they're going to create the conditions that would enable them to go ahead with their Green New Deal. So there are all these different organizations that are kind of working together, kind of pushing forth, this agenda.
Amazing.
Well, Susan, this is amazing what you're putting together. And I want to compliment you on the title of your book. Unmasked is such a perfect title for the world we're living in. And you're connecting a lot of different things together. I really want to go into depth about your book and what you're talking about now in the next hour, because sure. We're sitting on the top of the hour here. And you're connecting so many dots. This is fascinating. Especially, I want to get into this merging of the military-industrial complex with the pharmaceutical industries. I've never heard this said in the way that you just did, and I'm really intrigued by it. So you've opened the door to such a huge conversation for this next hour. This is going to be really good, and I'm just completely fascinated. Okay, here we are at the top of the hour with the music. Everyone stay tuned. We'll be right back with Susan Bradford. We're going to talk more about her book, Unmasked. Okay, welcome back to the third and final hour of Operation Scorpio. Giuseppe and myself are talking with author and muckraking journalist Susan Bradford, and we were just getting scratching the surface about her book, Unmasked. And you were hitting so many topics that were just right on. I was really impressed. But I really wanted to sort of question you about this merging of the military-industrial complex with the pharmaceuticals. Could you go into that into a little more depth, please?
Sure. I'm sure as you recall, a lot of strange occurrences began to happen during this last Bush administration, starting with 9/11. And in 2001, the Bush administration created the Defense Business Board, and what that was intended to do is to create civilian applications for military technology. So they were looking to kind of help their friends generate contracts through like taxpayer-funded R&D that they could then market to the people at large. in 2017, the Trump administration created the Defense Innovation Board, which it does seem to be a bit in alignment with the Green New Deal. They spoke about applying automation and technology as a defense weapon, and they're looking for applications to, among other things. It was intended to apply automation to different defense technologies. One of them, which was spearheaded by Eric Schmidt, he was the former head of Google, who kind of managed technology for Hillary Clinton's presidential campaign. She joined Jared Kushner. He joined Jared Kushner at the White House to help develop this. A vaccine that could potentially track citizens. So he was the head of the Defense Innovation Board at the White House, and they had already attempted to do this through a project called Operation Nightingale, whereby, and I know they got into a lot of trouble for this, but they would try to harvest information from patients and then use that data for tracking and predictive purposes, according to HIPAA laws, you cannot disclose a patient's personal health information, but there is an exception, and that exception is national security. So if you have a coronavirus and you have like China as a threat, potentially, you could track a person's health, for national security reasons. So they were working on kind of creating an app and creating a vaccine that would allow them to do that. To go back to the how this was set up through the coronavirus, during the Wuhan Games. The Wuhan Games, they were organized by a group called the International Military Sports Council, and that works with an International Committee of Military Medicine that coordinates with the WHO and the International Pharmaceutical Federation. So they collaborate and joint exercises around the world for armed forces and healthcare providers to respond to medical emergencies. So in a way, the coronavirus was like an experimental or trial run for what could potentially happen if you had a medical emergency. How would the countries and governments of the world respond to it? And at the very top of this structure is a group called Kinetic, and that's Q-I-N-E-T-I-Q, referencing that the agenda begins and ends with Q, that is the Queen. The Kinetic has acquired the patents, many of them stolen, for technologies they have the contracts for the FEMA camps, for all these new programs that they plan to lay out or roll out for the Green New Deal. They hold the patents for like self-driving cars and new technologies, and these technologies they were hoping to blend into the the response to the coronavirus. And the coronavirus itself was brought on because the Affordable Care Act basically bankrupted the healthcare industry and the individual healthcare market. So they had to figure out a way that they could cut down on expenses. And as you can tell, that the coronavirus cleared out the hospitals. A lot of the elderly who needed healthcare could not get it because they simply couldn't get access. And the government didn't have to spend as much taking care of them. So basically, they were looking at pushing the public onto the government healthcare rolls to maybe to advance rationing for healthcare treatments. But basically, you're looking at the defense industry collaborating with the healthcare industry to control medicines as part of an overreaching control system, if you will.
Yes, and this is fascinating because the COVID crisis that we're supposedly in, in some ways it's like the master key or the skeleton key that opens all the doors to these different agendas that you touched upon. You know, the climate change agenda is being magically fulfilled by this corona crisis, because all of a sudden, you know, people aren't traveling, people aren't going to work, not going to school. People are staying at home and doing everything via video. And of course, say hello to a smaller carbon footprint.
Correct.
So it's very interesting how this all connects together under the master key of COVID.
And I think it's very important that we kind of connect the dots so that the public can kind of use that key to kind of open the doors, if you will, to expose the agenda and to kind of, you know, push it back. Because you can see very clearly what, you know, how the these different institutes are working together and coordinating to advance this Green New Deal and, you know, these different agendas that they have in play.
Yes, and you mentioned Eric Schmidt, who is an avowed transhumanist as well. And, you know, I believe that this corona crisis is going to try to lead us into transhumanism, both with the vaccines that they have concocted, this witch's brew of genetics that we don't really understand, to sort of push everything along towards transhumanism as well.
I think that's true. The transhumanism is part of the technocratic agenda, because they want to create a society that is as efficient as possible. And, you know, having a robot that can, you know, work 365 days a year, 24/7 is a lot more efficient than an employee who requires healthcare benefits and takes breaks and maybe can only work a few hours a day. So they're trying to create like a more efficient a business plan. Like, so for example, you know, instead of paying maybe $80,000 a year for a healthcare director, you could have resumes, a search for keywords and controlled or controlled through algorithms to find find the right employee instead of actually paying somebody to do it. So they're looking at having automation basically replace people. And so in order for this to work, they have to kind of limit our expenditure and maybe look towards providing us with a subsistence level, like some type of guaranteed income. But that guaranteed income would only be enough for us to basically survive, like to pay a few bills, eat, have a very modest lifestyle. So it's going to limit what we can do. And then in a sense, it would allow them to control us, since we wouldn't have, you know, a lot of resources at our disposal. So we would all be, you know, welfare recipients who are dependent upon them for our survival.
Susan, I must say, I'm absolutely impressed with your muckraking investigative abilities. I highly compliment you. One statement you did make as you began to answer Scorpio's question, as you stated, the novel coronavirus, also known as SARS-CoV-2, might have been created in a lab. And I urge you to investigate the fact that it is absolutely was created in a lab, and no less than Dr. Luc Montagnier, the Nobel Prize winner for discovering the RNA snippet for HIV, has publicly stated, and it's on YouTube, it's hard to believe it hasn't been censored by those rodents, is he states that he will give back his Nobel Peace Prize, essentially making a bet that if anybody can prove him wrong, that this virus was created in a lab. And if you further research, you'll find that there's an international standard for genetically modified viruses, that there are certain markers within the virus that cannot be 100% match between species. And so there are multiple markers that not only reveal 100% match, which is absolutely proves it was created in lab, but there's other markers that track which labs it's been worked on. So it goes back to Fort Detrick, Maryland, then in North Carolina, Research Park Triangle, then Madison, Wisconsin, and then someone in the NIH had a common sense, and they banned this research. So Fauci himself funded it going on in Wuhan, China. And the woman who runs the Wuhan lab is a complete globalist and traitor to humanity, and has pushed this forward. And so it's interesting also, you may want to research that this was released over a year ago, and they're beginning to track more cases of it, and they've got it back to early 2019, which the mainstream media, of course, isn't reporting. But so other than that, I mean, that just even shows more of this agenda, and it's just so shocking. And my question is, are you aware of the 2010 Rockefeller report by the Rockefeller Foundation called Scenarios for the Future of Technology and International Development? Have you read that?
No. Can you tell me a little bit more about it?
Yes, it's fascinating. You know, there's something about these satanic secret societies that it appears, based on analysis of expert intrepid researchers, that they had, like Ole Domegaard and some others, that there's a code they must follow, that somehow they have to tell you in advance via predictive programming or outright telling you what they're going to do before they do it. But the general public pays it no heed. And this is shocking, because in 2010, they released this report, and it has the whole smug, smarmy philanthropist, we know better, we'll take care of you. And there's four scenarios that could potentially happen in this world with increasingly dangerous global bugs. And one of them, of the four, is called Operation Lockdown. And it, Lockdown, it is though they wrote reality, not a report, but it is exactly what we lived the last 6 months. It's unbelievable.
Yeah, that they do. They plan years in advance of exactly what they're going to do, and they just wait for that precise opportunity when they think it's going to have the greatest impact. But I would love to see that report. It sounds fascinating. It sounds like it can, provides a blueprint of exactly what we're experiencing now.
Right. And what's really interesting is, I don't know if you've seen the brilliant Canadian journalist now living in Japan, James Corbett. He has done an exceptional series exposing Bill Gates' agenda. And Bill Gates' 10-year initiative to become the vaccine messiah started in 2010, right around the time this report was issued. So you start to put together these pieces, and it's like, this is no coincidence, which we already know, but it's so easily provable. And so my question regarding all that is, when you began to dig into this dark reality, did that strengthen your Christian faith?
Did it strengthen my Christian faith? Well, I think my faith was already fairly strong to begin with. But I think, looking back, I think it really did, because once you can see the extent of the evil in the world, I think my impulse was to cling tighter to God. That I wanted his protection, and that their evil was so repulsive to me that, I think it made me even more, move more in the opposite direction. I don't know if you found that as well with yourself.
Oh, absolutely. What's interesting is, I don't know if you've noticed it, but you have a certain level of spiritual belief and practice, and then when you start to learn these things, and especially reveal them publicly, you become attacked on the spiritual level. And I dramatically increased, along with my wife, our daily nightly prayers to create, more energetic protections and things. Cause before we did that, the nightmares, and I've had, ever since I was a little boy, I have this weird, ability to kind of like go into a half sleep trance. And I see all these other realities, and I see this just amazing and terrifying visions. And for so long, I just thought it was nightmares. And as I became more spiritually adept, I realized what I was actually seeing. And those kind of protections are really important and have eliminated those attacks. Well, they're still there, but they don't get to penetrate as deeply as they had been before. Did you find that as well, that you needed to up your game?
Yeah, I think what you're talking about is a spiritual warfare. I would like to think I have a fairly good spiritual armor around me. I try to live from a position of a good, good intention, love and compassion for other people, from a position of integrity. And I think by adopting like the armor of God, it's harder for those types of influences to come in, because they're simply not an energetic or spiritual match, to what you are. I've worked on my spirituality over the years, and there's always room for improvement, but I'd like to think that I have a fairly strong armor of God around me, God willing, and a high degree of faith. I think that has protected me and has hopefully guided me quite well.
Well, and this is a very interesting point in the conversation, because I do really believe that spiritual protection, we need it more now than ever. We're facing a stronger counterforce than we ever have, at least in my lifetime. And one thing that I'm seeing, I wonder if you've noticed this as well, Susan, I'm seeing so-called world leaders who actually look like they're under some kind of possession. Some of these people have absolutely black eyes with no light coming out of them at all. Like, for example, the head of the United Nations has that. I've noticed that Governor Cuomo is starting to look that way. And just the other day, I saw Gavin Newsom speaking, and he was talking about climate change. And he got this evil grin on his face, like, hey, isn't it great that California is burning down and everything's screwed up here? And so I guess my question is, have you noticed, these so-called world leaders starting to look demonic?
They really do. I think there's one very striking image of Kamala Harris, where her eyes are completely black, and she looks like a different version of herself, like a demonically possessed version. But I think, like, in order for those politicians to get to those levels, they likely have to join the cabal. And as you know, the cabal is satanic. So, who knows what they're actually required to do to maintain their position for money and power. But absolutely, there's like a sadism about them. And I noticed that during the lockdown with I think it was the governor of Michigan, how excited they were about just imposing controls on the people. There's almost like a satanic or a sadistic glee that they had, intoxication with power that I found very disturbing.
Yeah, that's so true. And, the governor of Michigan, on first glance, she looks like a fairly attractive female. But if you look at her eyes and study her demeanor, she is very, wicked looking. And I think you're right, too. These people do have to join. When you join the cabal, you're joining a lot more than just a political organization. And that's one way they control the membership, is through the rituals and all the, bizarre behavior they have to engage in to stay in the club.
Yes, I agree. It's like, for the grace of God, go I. I know that they're very, evil, and hopefully they can be brought to justice. I wouldn't say I have sympathy for them, but I wouldn't trade anything to be in their shoes. So I think it must be, an awful existence, regardless of how much, money or power that, they have or claim to have. I wouldn't change positions with them at any point.
Oh, yeah. It's kind of like the Hotel California. You can't ever leave once you join that kind of organization. And that might be what that song was really about, too. And
it is. They do put a lot of truth in plain sight, and a lot of, of course they control the music and the entertainment industries. So all of these songs are an expression of ultimately of themselves, what they're engaged in.
It's interesting, on the many flights I took on the Lolita Express, Bill Clinton, Bill Gates, and I would talk about these things, and they were quite comfortable selling their souls. It's interesting.
But were you really on the Lolita Express, or are you kidding?
I'm just joking.
What don't I know about you?
But you kept your underwear on, right, Giuseppe?
And I never inhaled. So
there you go.
Yeah, these people are really something else. What do you think of Kamala Harris? Do you think will she be the next president? Do you think Joe Biden will make it to the finish line, or?
Well, I'll just briefly go into this, and then I'll hand it over to Giuseppe. Well, you know, they've sort of foreshadowed the idea that Joe Biden isn't going to be around too long. You know, they've been dropping little breadcrumbs about that. And so, you know, the beauty is, I think she's an empty vassal. She'll do whatever she's told, just like Biden. Mm-hmm. But the beauty of Kamala Harris is that if she becomes president and you don't like anything she does, you're a misogynist and a racist. So it's sort of like checkmate, you know?
Yeah, and ironically, I guess she owns slaves, or her family owns slaves, and she's not really black. I think she's Indian and maybe part white, part Indian, so she really isn't even an African-American, but she's kind of claiming to be.
And she has some Jamaican heritage. That's where the slave ownership was.
Ah, okay. Yeah, a lot of hypocrisy, and I think I heard, too, that she can't legally run for office, I think because she's maybe an anchor baby, or the child of two unnaturalized citizens.
Right. No, she's not an anchor baby. She was born in California, but neither one of her parents were citizens when she was born. And, you know, to be a natural born citizen, you have to be born in America of both parents who are American citizens. And, you know, technically you have to be that to be president or vice president. But, you know, that's all being covered up by both parties and the media. And of course, Barack Obama already took care of any sort of formalities or details like that with his presidency.
It reminds me of the fall of Rome. You know, after they right before the fall, the empire was invaded by the hordes, and their leadership was no longer legitimate. So, if you know, God forbid, if Kamala were to prevail, you know, we would have an illegitimate government.
And I would like to add that I would rather vote for Kamala, the Ugandan warrior wrestler who recently passed away, than I would for Kamala Harris. I mean, her history of how she climbed the ladder by climbing on top of downtown Willie Brown as a young woman is just, that's how the game is played, but it's not even a secret. It's public knowledge. And her, a regular marijuana user, and then she imprisoned thousands of people on marijuana charges. This woman is such a despicable hypocrite and a puppet, yet, and she's Biden is not in good health, so you're absolutely right. I mean, she is being placed into the one breath away from the presidency. And it's interesting, nobody brings up back in the early days of the Democratic debates when they would assemble about 2,000 candidates, and how Tulsi Gabbard just took her apart in an early debate and pretty much destroyed her candidacy. And real journalists should be bringing up those same points and saying, how is this woman deserving of being the VP? And don't hear a peep.
Yeah, she barely even got like 1% of the vote.
Yeah, yeah. Okay, we're at the bottom of the hour break, and we'll jump right back into this conversation in just a few minutes. Stay tuned. Okay, welcome back to the final half hour of Operation Scorpio. We're having a really interesting conversation with journalist Susan Bradford. And at the bottom of the hour break, we were kind of talking about Kamala Harris, and I want you to finish up your thoughts, but I just wanted to add one thing about her. And that, you know, if you remember in the debate, she told this heart-wrenching story of how that little girl that was bussed, that was me. And, you know, it turns out her father was a professor at Stanford University. So it's not like she was living in the hood or something like that. So it's a totally phony disingenuous story, and it's a real insight into her character.
I think she was a prosecutor, and she was also developing a policy whereby children who were truant would she proposed arresting the parents of truant children, so those would be like children who are already disadvantaged. So she maybe kick them when they're down. That was at least.
Yes, but she, according to the media now, she really feels for people, and she's just an incredible rock star kind of personality, is what the mainstream media is calling her. Susan, could you give us a little information on where to get your books, the best way to get them, and what books you're currently offering?
Sure. So my website is www.susanbradford.org, and that provides thumbnails of my books. I can go through them if you're interested. The first one that I wrote was The Full Court Press. That was with senior foreign correspondent Tom Fenton. And that addresses the different PR strategies that the Bush administration rolled out to maintain information dominance during the war in Iraq. And then the next one is Lynched. Lynched provides a comprehensive backstory to the Abramoff investigation. From there, I wrote The United Church of Heist. And that was based upon the United Church of Christ, which my grandfather founded. He wrote the founding constitution. So once I began to see, there were a lot that the church had very dramatically swayed from its original purpose. I researched the backstory on how the globalists had taken it over, and I came to see how Obama turned that church into a political machine for the left. The next book is the second American Revolution, or I beg your pardon, the Shadow Dragon. That book reveals how our political establishment sold the United States, sold our country out to communist China. And that was based on a secret deal that was hatched during the Yalta Conference at the end of World War II, and in which the global elites had decided to reduce the United States to the world's largest welfare state, and they intended to bankrupt us while elevating communist China, which they'd also created, into the world superpower, into the global marketplace and leader of the New World Order. The next book was the Second American Revolution. In that book, I revealed how the Russians were able to purge their Bolsheviks in the 1970s. At which point, Henry Kissinger, who was a double agent for both the Rockefellers and Rothschilds, placed them into power within our political establishment, creating many of the problems that we have today. So the Bolsheviks took over all, the extended, very extensive networks in the universities, governments, foundations, media, et cetera, that the Rockefellers had created. And so they gave birth to the radical Bolshevik left and then the neoconservative right. And it also reveals how the Russians are working behind the scenes to kind of to thwart some of their designs. And then recently I wrote Unmasked, the coronavirus story, which reveals the different political and financial networks that gave rise to the coronavirus. And I also show how these same networks are financing the riots that are coursing through our cities, like Black Lives Matter and so forth. And then recently I wrote a book called It's Fleeced, F-L, and the E's are written as threes instead of E's. So it's Fleeced with E's, three for the E's, to represent the technocracy. And this book is on the coming technocratic dystopia, which is a companion book to Unmasked, and it reveals how the Green New Deal is how the coronavirus is being used to advance the Green New Deal. And that book was actually inspired by a recent Supreme Court case in which the Supreme Court ceded half of the state of Oklahoma to the Indian tribes. And I show how that happened, how that was set up, why it happened, and how that's part of the larger larger globalist agenda. And so all of the books are available on Amazon. And of course, I always welcome hearing from any of my readers or receiving any questions. And, I do my best to answer you know, any questions or queries that come to me. But yeah, so my website.
Okay, and your books, are they available on your website as well, or only Amazon?
Only Amazon. I should make them available on my website, but I haven't done yet. You can just
And give your website one more time, please.
Sure. It's my name, which is Susan Bradford, and then .org.
Susan, it's interesting that this year, 2020, it seems as though the globalists, power, have gone all in with pursuing this fundamental change to society. It's no longer a gradual uphill, or I guess I should say downward decline. I mean, they are out to destroy the sovereign nation of the United States of America and replace it with something that's in the North American Union, something that is basically eliminating physical cash and going to digital currency. It looks like they want to have mandatory vaccinations. It looks like they want to have social credit scores. It looks like they want to have that quantum digital tattoo that Bill Gates has a patent on, essentially the mark of the beast. Why do you think all of a sudden they went like those late night championship poker shows on ESPN back in the day? Why do you think the globalist parasites went all in this year?
I think that the Obama administration had expected to finish the deal. Like they had planned essentially to surrender the United States to China. And I think that since Obama couldn't complete the transformation within two terms, Hillary Clinton was going to finish off the agenda. If you recall, her campaign slogan was "Stronger Together," which was an interesting slogan when she's dividing the country and calling everybody, you know, calling conservatives racist and homophobes and you know, sexist and so forth.
Oh, so that's an excellent point.
Yeah, so stronger together meant that the elites would be stronger together. Like, we have to come together to do one final push to get us over the finish line. It wasn't stronger as a nation. It was we as elites together, we can make this happen. We're unbreakable. So about a month before the election, the Chinese won, entered the basket of currencies, SDR. I can't think of the name of it escapes me, but it was set to become the global currency, and they had planned that once Hillary won, the collapse would begin. So I think now with Trump, they realize that they have a very fierce adversary on behalf of the American people who is pushing back against the agenda. I think they're afraid of losing everything that they have. They have struggled to obtain, and in my opinion, what it appears to me is that they're engaging in a sort of like a scorched earth policy that, you know, if we can't have the world, you can't either. And so they're trying to destroy kind of everything in any way that they can. So it seems like an act of desperation, you know, with what they're doing.
I totally agree. And, you know, one of your books was touching on the idea that China is to be sort of the vanguard or the new head of the world order in some ways. And, you know, I see that because there's such an effort to essentially export the Chinese system and sort of overlay it onto the United States using coronavirus as the excuse for it.
That's true, and this was kind of advanced during the Nixon administration. You know, remember that Nixon opened up China with Kissinger, and I believe that George Herbert Walker Bush was the ambassador to Taiwan, or he was helping to set this up. And as they were looking into China, they saw that there were a billion plus people, and they thought this is going to be the perfect market because these are, you know, over a billion people who don't have anything, and we could make obscene amounts of profit by turning them into consumers and, you know, building up their society. And I think they also knew that since China was still kind of part of the old world, that they could use China as an experiment to build up this technocracy with the credit scores, with an authoritarian government, and then export that type of government and system to the rest of the world. So I think you're absolutely right. You know, that's what they were trying to do.
Susan, what do you make of the mind control entrainment, the latest two new phrases that are everywhere, new normal and the great reset?
That's very interesting. I think they want the new normal to become a fait accompli. Like you have, there was one fellow, he has a very difficult to pronounce a name, but he goes by Venki. He's the head of the Royal Society and also one of the team leaders of the Medical Research Council in London. And he was saying that, we should get used to the new normal of wearing a mask as if it were a piece of clothing. And he says it should be considered socially unacceptable as driving drunk, so they're trying to create a new normal, but through mind control. But the reality is that this is all contrived, and we can very quickly go back to the old normal just with sufficient political will.
That's exactly right. Well stated.
Well, thank you. And I think there was a second part to the question. I don't know if I answered that or. It was a new normal and something else.
Oh, I said the two entrainment phrases are new normal and the great reset. They constantly are talking about the great reset as well.
Yeah, that's something I'm not too sure about. It may mean that the economy is about, there's a bubble in the economy, so it could mean that it's about to to collapse, which hopefully it will not happen. But I think in terms of the globalist lexicon, that means deindustrializing the United States, like resetting it back to normal with, eliminating the smog, eliminating, modern conveniences. So it might have something to do with that.
Yeah. And, the other thing I find fascinating about this Corona, Operation Corona, let's call it, is mm-hmm. that these shadowy elite or these hidden overlords, they've come out and they're just basically saying, look, we own and run this system. We can shut it down when we say, and we can reconstruct a new system more to our liking at our will. So the show of raw power that we're seeing is unprecedented, and I've never seen anything like it in my lifetime, certainly.
I absolutely agree with you. It really just shows you how much power that they have very gradually acquired. And now it's like, all or nothing. They're going to try to, exert as much of it as they can to push through their agenda. But I think it's absolutely frightening. But doesn't it seem like they've overplayed their hand a bit?
I agree. And I think they've also done is they've unknowingly revealed so much about the way they control the system and just how controlled everybody is. I think they've revealed more than they intended to, and the game is becoming more clear to more and more people, I believe.
That's very true. And I think a lot of their power is it's really through their ability to control reality, their control the perception of reality. And now that a lot of people are seeing through fake news and they're able to see through the deception and think for themselves, and even communicate online as we're doing, that it's becoming increasingly difficult for them to control the narrative and to keep the agenda alive.
That's exactly right. My other question that I'm curious to get your thoughts upon is how the Democratic Party, it appears, has been gutted, much like in the original Men in Black, when Vincent D'Onofrio's character, who was an abusive husband, got pulled down into the hole where the spaceship was, and the alien put his skin on as an Agar suit. And it seems to me that and he came back to talk with the Men in Black, Tommy Lee Jones and Will Smith, and he had flies around him because of the decaying skin. It seems to me that that is what has happened to the Democratic Party, where it is now controlled by that vile traitor George Soros, And they've been supporting Bolshevik 2.0. I mean, this rioting in the streets, this is insane over-focus on Black Lives Matter when there's plenty of black people who have enjoyed American success and the American dream. Right. And yet, I mean, it's and these Democratic governors and these Democratic mayors and police chiefs are allowing night upon night, week after week, now month after month of burning, looting, pulling people out of their vehicles and beating them. And in one case last week in Frederick, Maryland, this young black punched a man and killed him, and he's not even being charged. It's insane. And what are your thoughts on this Bolshevik Revolution 2.0?
Black Lives Matter and like these rioters, they're actually being funded by the multinationals through the churches. Ironically, it's through the Congregational Community Organizers. They were set up during the previous Obama administration, and they're being unleashed on us now. I mean, it appears that they're being used to prolong the economic distress of the country, to shutter more businesses, to help the Democrats win this upcoming election so that they can push through their agenda. But I think that they're basically attacking like old America. So they want to get rid of all the traditions of freedom, constitutional protections, liberty, all of those traditions that made America exceptional, made us, the greatest country in the world. So they're trying to kind of eradicate those and exploiting slavery which is a terrible sin. But the reality is that these globalists are using slavery to this day, for example, to mine for cobalt, which is a substance that's used to make their electric cars. They're involved in human trafficking, and they were the ones who actually brought slaves to America through the through the East India Company and through their international merchants. Americans were the ones who spilled their blood to free the slaves. This is a country about freedom and not enslavement. So they're actually trying, accusing us of what they've done in order to advance their agenda. And it's my hope that a lot of people will begin to see through, what they're trying to do, and that hopefully we can come together as a nation. But it is being financed by the multinationals, these community organizers.
What are your thoughts on the Democratic Party putting up such a pathetic convention, such a pathetic candidate, that in reality the globalists want Trump to win? Because what a silent majority member in a flyover state is going to vote Democratic after witnessing the nightmare of these riots? So let's assume that possibly their agenda is to get Trump another term, and which point the weak-minded Antifa members, the weak-willed BLM operatives, they go insane and they burn cities down. Do you think that's a possibility?
Well, what I saw in Tulsa, for example, the Black Lives Matter were trying to shutter a Trump convention, and Trump was there to promote oil and gas exploration while they are trying to promote the green energy agenda. So it appears that they are working against him, and that they're not like part of a distraction, where they're trying to get Trump reelected. And I think this pathetic display from the Democratic convention really shows how completely bankrupt and out of ideas that they are. I mean, they have absolutely nothing to offer, and really no creativity, no quality control. I mean, they're completely, they don't even appear to be ready to govern. They have really nothing to offer. And I think that's on full display with this Democratic convention.
Yeah. And again, this corona crisis is benefiting Biden, because for one thing, Trump can no longer hold his, massive rallies where there's 30,000 people inside and another 5 or 10,000 waiting to get in. And so we don't get to contrast his ability to draw a crowd versus Joe Biden probably, you know, packing in 400 or 500 people at best. So, you know, again, the Democrats are having a lot of good luck as the result of this corona hoax.
Yeah, they appear to be trying, but I think it was revealed recently that even in these Zoom conventions that they're trying to hold, that they had like multiple people appearing in different squares because they couldn't even get enough people to fill their Zoom. So I think, you know, we're seeing like maybe a lack of enthusiasm for the little that they do have.
Oh yeah, and it's a great platform. Biden saying, "I'm going to force everyone to wear a mask, and I'm going to raise your taxes." That's the kind of stuff that wins elections, huh?
Yeah, I would take him at his word. That's exactly what he's going to do. Hillary's saying,
"Yeah, let's take him at his word on that one for sure." I think that this is going to be a very dirty election. And I don't know, this whole, you know, great mailbox conspiracy is really sad and pathetic. And do you think that, you know, they can do voting through the mail? I just don't see how they can do it without massive cheating.
I would agree with that. And I think a lot of the postal workers are unions. So I think they would naturally be Democratic. And you know how, you know, the Democrats do play dirty. So I think, you know, you need to have some type of quality control there.
Absolutely. And Susan, we're almost at the top of the hour. This time with you has really flown by. And, you know, as the conversation progressed, I got more and more impressed with your depth of knowledge and your ability to connect different happenings into a central agenda. And I want to thank you for coming on. And I hope that we can have you come on again soon, because this has been a great conversation.
Oh, well, thank you so much. I enjoyed speaking with both of you as well. And I'd be delighted to come back at any time. So, let's plan for some other time to talk again.
Okay, great. And so what would be any, like, your final thoughts for today, if you will?
thank you for that. I would like to encourage your listeners that despite any concerns you may have with Trump, and I've had, you know, a few over the years, he really is our best chance of defeating the globalists. I do believe he's sincere, and he is doing, you know, what needs to be done, you know, in terms of supporting our energy security and in pushing back against the coronavirus agenda. So I'd like to encourage all of you to, you know, if you can, to get behind him so that we can prevail, you know, in this agenda and hopefully, you know, bring him, you know, make America great again and greater than before.
So yes, and he did call it out as a hoax at the very beginning. He said, "Folks, this is a hoax." And he also said that this virus is going to go away without a vaccine. So there you go. Giuseppe, what are your final thoughts?
Well, my final thoughts are, as I began researching Susan Bradford, I realized she should be the vice presidential candidate. And but I don't think that's going to happen. But I mean, just so impressive that she is a driven, reasoned, disciplined, real muckraking journalist. As I've gotten laughs out of her, I no longer practice those journalistic protocols. I share all my insights, because at some point, you know, it's gotten so bad, you have to use truth and humor to perhaps shake people out of their entrainment and entrancement. And I just want to compliment you, and I look forward to having you back on either one of our shows. And if there's ever anything that you have that's fascinating breaking news, we didn't really even get into your latest book, Fleeced. I really wanted to get the insights into the research of, I didn't look into it enough to understand what was the bizarre thing that suddenly they announced that like half the state belongs to the Indians. And I know you wrote a book about it. So I just, hats off, compliments, and would consider you a friend of the show.
Oh, well, thank you so much. And you're both, you know, really great, great patriots. And I really appreciate all that you're doing, you know, to you know, to educate the people, because information is power, and with that power, we can use our voices and our influence as citizens, you know, to influence the government for the better.
Okay, and Susan, could you just give out your website one last time?
Sure, it's www.susanbradford.org.
And as Giuseppe said, your newest book is called Fleeced. Is that correct?
That's correct. It's FL then 33C3D. So it's kind of written in a technocratic way. Hopefully, it doesn't lose anybody.
Yeah, that's your choice of titles for your books are really impressive. And, you know, it's said that there's beauty in simplicity, and you really nail the subject in this one single word, and they're all compelling titles. And again, I'd like to thank you for coming on. This has been such a great conversation, and I'm sure we'll get together soon. And, yeah, like Giuseppe said, if you have any, you know, breaking news or anything you want to bring up, feel free to contact us, and we'll have another conversation.
I will definitely do so.
Okay, well, that's the music. The time really flew by. Thanks, everybody, for listening. We'll see you next week. Bye-bye.